Good morning and welcome to the world's greatest race course. Everybody feeling, everybody in a good mood this morning? Everybody fired up, ready to go? Very nice. I'll just remind you, if you're playing along, we all get out of here a lot sooner. My name's Dave Wilson. I'm with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network, as well as WIBC Radio here in Indianapolis. I'm also a business owner. I've been a race fan since I was a little boy. Grew up right over here at 30th in Georgetown, so this is my one of my loves of my life, being here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And I welcome to you, if you're a regular cover, if you cover the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indianapolis 500, or the IndyCar Series on a regular basis, thank you and welcome. If you're new here, we hope you had a great time, and if you have questions, we'll be glad to answer those questions if I can or somebody else can, to continue to help foster your interest in covering all things about the IndyCar Series as well as the ethanol. We're here today to talk about ethanol and to have a great time. You know, ethanol, of course, 100% ethanol being used here at the Indianapolis 500 by every car. It was actually used for the first time, I got to make sure I get this right, in 1927 by Leon DeRay, used it over 70 years ago, the first time ethanol was used here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So it's not the very first time that ethanol was used completely here, but it is the first time the entire field has been running complete ethanol. We have a lot of speakers and a lot to get to today, and so let's get moving along here. And at any time you have questions, let us know. But we will have a question and answer series segment at the end of the program, so stay tuned for that. My first guest just got a promotion not too long ago. He is the Indy Racing League Commercial. He's in charge, the president of the Indy Racing League Commercial Division. After serving as the Indianapolis Motor Speedway's Vice President of Marketing for nearly 6 years, he is responsible, get this, there's a lot of, to do here, for sales, marketing, public relations, broadcast relationships, business planning and development, and organizational operation of the IndyCar Series and Indy Pro Series. Please welcome to the podium here Mr. Terry Anstadt. Terry?
Thank you very much, Dave, and I really would like to welcome everyone here, everyone involved with our business, our friends from Chevrolet, our friends from Honda, really key partners that really make this business work. But I'd also like to thank Tom Salinica, everyone at the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council, for their support of the IndyCar Series and the partnership with us in being the first in motorsports to debut a renewable fuel. It's also important to note that both of our Hoosier senators, Bay and Lugar, have been at the leading edge of developing ethanol as a fuel. Ethanol continues to be at the forefront of discussions about oil dependence, America's economy, and environmental conservation. The IndyCar Series, which has been recognized for its leadership in safety and technology in automobile racing, is now the motorsports leader in renewable and environmentally responsible fuel produced in America, a racing first. Our high-tech and high-speed Honda Indy V8 engines are powered by 100% fuel-grade ethanol during the entire 17-race season that kicked off at Homestead Miami Speedway in March. And now ethanol comes to the Indy 500. This has been the first time in 40 years that a new fuel has been incorporated into open-wheel racing. Since the Indianapolis Motor Speedway was founded in 1909, innovation has been a hallmark of our tradition. Today, the IndyCar Series carries that legacy forward with ethanol. The IndyCar Series and the Indianapolis 500, the world's largest single-day sporting event, are a perfect platform to expose consumers and our race fans to ethanol. The long-term message is clear. If a 650-horsepower IndyCar Series car that covers the length of a football field in a second can run safely and efficiently on 100% fuel-grade ethanol, so can your vehicle on E85 sold at the pump. And reduced emissions are kind of a side benefit for that. The ethanol story for our fans isn't only on the track, but certainly also off. This weekend, our fans will drive here and face some of the highest gas prices in our country's history. And we feel that ethanol can be an effective solution and alleviate some of that pain at the pump. Ethanol is going to help provide part of the solutions to the problems we face in our environment and our dependence on Middle East oil. We urge consumers to follow the lead of our national leaders and support the country's focus on renewable fuels. The IndyCar series shares the President's commitment to energy security, and we accept the challenge of making these goals a reality. As a clean-burning fuel that is non-toxic and 100% biodegradable, it reduces air pollution and improves racing's environmental footprint. I also want to take this opportunity to salute former IndyCar Series driver Paul Dana for his efforts in bringing ethanol to the IndyCar Series. It was Paul's vision and diligence that matched up the ethanol industry with the IndyCar Series. And Paul's legacy will be part of racing history at the IndyCar Series and the Indy 500 forever. Paul drove change in motorsports and helped amplify energy awareness to the world. Thank you to all who are here today advancing the use of ethanol, and we are proud to be with you. Thank you.
Up next, a gentleman who's going to talk about the acceptance of ethanol and why consumers play such an important role in that, from EPIC, the Ethanol Promotion and Information Council. Please welcome Mr. Tom Salinica. Tom?
Thank you. Well, with that intro, I guess I can pretty much throw this speech away because that wasn't what I was going to say. But it is true that the Ethanol Promotion Information Council was designed, built, and has been implementing exactly that vision to help promote the ethanol to all consumers across this country. Through our partnership with really all of the speakers today, from the environmental platform of Will Steger, through, of course, the amazing race performance of the Indy Racing League, the Ethanol Promotion Information Council is reaching consumers by the millions. This is a new entry for the ethanol industry. The ethanol industry has long been said as it's the overnight 20-year success. And we've got a lot of pioneers here in the room that have been working on ethanol for that long, if not longer. They have known for a long time the value that ethanol will bring to our economy, both rural and urban. They've known for a long time what ethanol will do for our environment. And they've been out doing the hard work and reaching people as they could. But today, with the stage that we have, we're reaching many, many more people that those pioneers could only hope to do. But it's only because of the partnerships that we forged that we are able to do that. Partnerships with General Motors, partnerships with other racing leagues like the American Le Mans, partnerships with EPA and DOE. All of these partnerships are going to be vitally important for the average consumer to have that choice. And that's really what it's about. It's the opportunity to have a choice. For the last 100 years, consumers have pulled up to the pump and they've chosen petrochemicals. Now, they performed exceedingly well. Obviously, we're the richest nation in the world, and oil played a big part in that. But we've got to look down the road. We've got to look at our environment and say, what kind of change do we want to impact today? What are we going to do today to make sure that tomorrow is just slightly brighter? Either through economics or in the environment, we've got to start looking for change. Every time we turn around, there's a negative story that's just lingering underneath the surface about ethanol. There's those that are not ready to take the challenge that this audience has taken and has been promoting for many, many years. We have to stand together. We have to make that choice. And by working together, the ethanol industry and all of you in this audience, all of our partners, we're going to help consumers to understand that, yeah, I can go up to that pump, I can find ethanol, I can look for that E brand, and I can say, hey, I'm doing something today. Maybe it's not dramatic. Maybe I didn't plant a tree. Maybe I didn't, recycle all of my goods today, but I made a difference, and it was easy for me to do. And it's because of the ethanol industry pulling together and letting people know that that change is available for them that we're all going to make a change for tomorrow. Thank you very much for coming, and together we can make a change. You are the leaders, and you are the ones that will impact tomorrow. Thank you.
Tom? Sorry, I picked up the wrong cliff notes there, Tom. I apologize. Our next guest, I tell you what, they had a heck of a promotion at Gas America yesterday. If you heard about it, at 52nd and Lafayette Road, they were selling E10 for $2.25 a gallon, which matched the pole speed of this year's Indianapolis 500. I figured the next time I saw gas for under $3 a gallon, I'd see clean bathrooms at a service station too. And I went to Gas America, clean bathrooms, and then I think they didn't have the key. I always hate that when you go to get the key to the bathroom and it's hooked to like a spare tire. Don't you hate that? It wasn't that way at all. So a very important man and a retailer and a guy who had a lot of business yesterday. Please welcome Mr. Jim Gentry from Gas America. Jim?
No, it wasn't hooked to a spare tire, but we would like our key back, Dave. That's why we put it on spare tires. I guess you will. Yes, you will. On behalf of Gas America, our over 600 employees, our management and staff at 90 stores in Indiana and Ohio, I want to thank all of you for being here, and we're very pleased to be here. Gas America has been a blender of ethanol into every grade of gasoline that we sell for over 20 years. So it's nothing new to us. Actually, we began in the ethanol business way back. It really wasn't that fashionable to be an ethanol blender back in the 80s. But we believed in the product throughout. We knew that it was a quality product from the start. It certainly hasn't changed in quality, and it has given us at our retail, at our 90 stores, a product that we feel confident that we can take out to the street. Our customers certainly like it. We have no issues whatsoever with those customer bases, and by virtue of the fact that we had a very long line from 11:30 till 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon of people coming in to buy gas, not just the 2 1/4 a gallon, but they were aware it had ethanol in it. They were aware of their promotion, and it sure didn't keep anybody away. We like to think of ourselves at Gas America as representative of a broad base of ethanol blenders throughout the country. There are more and more people joining in the retail blending of ethanol. That's what we do best. We think that we're pros at it after 20 years, and we continue to build our business based on ethanol blends in all grades of our gasoline. We're absolutely a huge supporter of all the ethanol production that is coming online both in Indiana and throughout the country. That's only going to benefit us to get our supply closer into our blending facilities, closer to our stores, and as more ethanol retail blenders expand their blending production in Ohio or Michigan or Illinois, wherever, will help provide those gallons that are needed for blending. We blend something in the order of about 1 million gallons a month, which is somewhat small potatoes when it comes to ethanol blending, but it is sizable for us, and we certainly enjoy every gallon that we blend. That being said, we certainly wish to offer our best wishes to all the drivers in the race, and we will continue to blend ethanol in every new store that we build, and we hope that we'll see you at our stores soon. Thank you.
Of course, Ray Hall Letterman, entry number 17, driven by Jeff Simmons, is sponsored by ethanol, and there are several people to thank for that involvement, and we'd like to recognize him if we could, too, from poet Mr. Jeff Broyne, who Jeff could not be here this evening or this morning. We'd also like to thank from Fagan Incorporated, Mr. Ron Fagan. Ron, if you're here, if you'd stand up, just say hello. There he is, right? Where is he here, Ron? Where's Ron? There you are. Ron, nice to meet you. Thank you very much, sir. Ron Fagan. And this next young gentleman who is coming up here from ICM, these are the people that put this all together and are the ones that are putting up some money here to keep Jeff Simmons on the racetrack, from ICM Incorporated, Mr. Dave Vandergrind. Dave?
Well, I'd like to welcome everyone here. Been here in Indy now for about 4 years, and every year it's just kind of a It's kind of an exciting, active place to be at. But I would also like to thank Brian Barnhart and Jeff George for their participation, the IRL's participation in switching from methanol to ethanol at the racetrack this year. At the end of the day, you know, I would have never thought, and I don't think Ron or Jeff Broin would have ever thought 5 years ago when Paul Dana came to us and said, I have an idea. He said, we need to promote ethanol in motorsports. And I thought, well, I think he's just looking for a ride, and he's trying to find somebody to sponsor him. And whether that was or not, I do not know today. But Paul was an avid advocate of this, and I think he dogged Brian Barnhart and Tony George for a long time, trying to convince them and tell them the benefits of ethanol and the ethanol in the Indy Racing League. And we came together 3 years ago and put agreement to switch to 10% ethanol in the race fuel last year and go 100% fuel ethanol this year. And that was really through the hard work and effort of Paul Dana, who was talked about earlier. And his legacy will live on, just like Indianapolis Racetrack, where this is the place where innovations and new things are tried. And they really took another step in the road of that success by pioneering, again, the use of 100% ethanol on a racetrack. One of the things we really did get out of this that we really, I guess you'd say, didn't expect or didn't know, as we have been trying to promote ethanol through the EPIC partnership, there's kind of a three-legged stool, we say. There's the performance side of it, which is demonstrated here. There's the environmental side of it, the reduced tailpipe emissions with 10% blending of ethanol. And there's the economic side of it. And we've been able to leverage all three of those things through the Indy Racing League, through the performance that we've seen here, through the environmental benefits, and absolutely the economic benefits. We are building plants that are moving to the east. We just did a startup of a plant in Clymers, Indiana. And there's a number of plants that both Fagan and ICM and Poet have under construction in this area. So the industry is moving east, and that probably has a lot to do with the exposure we've got from racing. And from a economic side, we are retaining funds in this country. We are recycling and reusing the dollars that otherwise would be sent overseas to some people who actually don't have us on their Christmas card list. So this really is an opportunity to grow what we grow. And as we look at this, we are beginning to close the gap between our production capabilities of grains and our internal consumption of those same products. And as we do that, we are looking to the next. What is the next thing that we can do? What is the next section of the bridge, as I like to call it? There's a bridge here between energy dependence, where we're at today, and energy independence, where we'd like to be tomorrow. And ethanol is one section of that bridge. Fuel ethanol from grain is the first section. There's a lot of other things we can be doing. There's wind, there's solar, there's also the cellulosic ethanol that we are now starting to shift our focus to, and saying, what is the next thing we can do to continue our move and our mandate, I guess the government mandate, to say we want to be energy independent. And there has been a lot of collaboration to make that happen between universities, between government, some of them all represented here, between industry, to say how can we move the bar as fast as we can and start taking other products that we produce here, other renewable products, and convert them to ethanol. As this ethanol technology evolves from cellulose, we will have the opportunity to see the ethanol the energy independence in this country that we need. We will be able to see the environmental improvements that we really need, and we will see some economic improvements. Anybody that kind of looks a little bit at history and things like that, when agriculture is good, about 3 to 5 years later, so is everything else. And we right now have a very strong, active economy, and that is not totally devoid of the fact that we have a strong agricultural economy, a strong domestic use of products that we produce. And I am extremely proud to be part of an industry that is making a difference. And each one of you in this room here can make a difference in your own way. You can ask for ethanol. You can get involved. You can look at ethanol, drivingethanol.org on the website, see the different things and the benefits that can happen. And I'm also proud to be associated with the IRL, who has taken this forward step to bring a performance fuel to the forefront and demonstrate what it can do. Ray Hall Letterman, who has partnered with us to showcase the car, and Jeff Simmons, who is also the driver who has taken over for Paul Dana and has really done a stellar job dropping into a very, very difficult position to help us promote this product. And thank you very much, and I am also proud just to be here.
Our next speaker was unanimously confirmed by the Senate as America's 9th Assistant Secretary for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy. That's EERE. So you got to remember that, because that's a lot easier to say than that last thing, see? The Assistant Secretary manages the Department of Energy's $1.47 billion Applied Science Research and Development and Deployment Portfolio, which promotes marketplace integration of renewable and environmentally sound energy technologies. His office also bears primarily responsibility for education, conservation, regulation, and efficient use of our nation's energy resources, including federal energy management, building codes, applied standards, and ENERGY STAR programs. There you have it. Please welcome, if the Assistant Secretary, if you will, Mr. Andy Karshner. Andy?
That's much ado about nothing. Thank you very much. Got 5 minutes. This is a great thing. I get to fly into the Motor Speedway, give you 5 minutes overview, and tell you just how proud I am to be amongst you today. I want to thank everybody who made it possible for me to be here today, because we only gave you about 24 hours notice that I was going to drop in. Last year I came with the secretary. We planned it for about 6 months and had a different thing. I wanted this to be the first event after some time that I had taken off. I've taken a few weeks off because I had a baby within the week. I had a baby. And so I've been taking time off. But this group is real important to me. And so, Tom, thank you for all your efforts, and Dave and Ron Fagan and all the people that are making baby Julia's future a little bit brighter. I came here to personally tell you thank you. In addition to my professional role, to say we've got to keep engaging you in the way that we have been, to keep accelerating and proliferating and replicating and having this unprecedented growth rate in clean domestic biofuels production that we've enjoyed for the last half decade, that we intend to push further, because we have to. This country has a lot of challenges right now, challenges that we have not yet been prepared with a scale and a rate to meet, that the people in this room are responsible for helping us meet. We know that we have people abroad in harm's way. And so even this weekend, right before Memorial Day, as we celebrate this great institutional event, it's part of the American psyche, we've got to remember that there are folks out there fighting for us against some of those folks that will never send us Christmas cards, people that would like to leverage energy economics over our future, people who might deprive my daughter of being able to inherit the American dream in the way that you and I have known it. And so we're building that hedge domestically at an unprecedented rate. And we also have, you'll hear about in a minute, very big challenge of global climate change, a serious challenge that this country is going to increasingly engage in the leadership of the solutions that have to be offered. And that, too, is entailed in the President's 20 and 10 plan. 20 and 10 is what the President announced during the State of the Union. With all the other news out there, it might have got lost a little bit. I want to remind you about how significant it is. 20% reduction in our gasoline consumption within the decade. It's never been called for before. It is unprecedented in size, in scope, and in timetable. up to 35 billion gallons of ethanol production. We need your help to get Congress serious. We have bipartisan leadership in Congress that is engaging the administration on this issue, but we're moving towards the media fun of a presidential season. And they say, well, the president's in his last thing. It's a lame duck. And don't buy it. It's too important. The gas prices, Memorial Day, this event on Sunday should be reminders of how serious our challenges are, whether it is environmental stewardship or our energy security or our economic competitiveness. We are faced with the greatest competition this country's yet known. And in all these things, our domestic biofuels industry is building our hedge, is giving us a better hand to play. And so I'm very grateful to be amongst you. I wanted to tell you how important it is to keep engaging you all professionally. That's why the president doubled the biofuels and biomass budget for research and development and deployment. That's why we've committed at least $500 million in the last couple months alone over the next several years to stand up new cellulosic biorefinery capacity in the first six are currently being negotiated, but it means a lot more than that. It's this multi-generational commitment that we have got to make, and it's not unlike this race. You know, this race is about speed, it's about performance, it's about endurance, and ultimately, it's about victory. And so I think it's a fitting microcosm for the challenges that we have as a country, and I think I couldn't be more grateful that there are people like you all of all parties, of all different professions that have come here around this great institution to show off what America has and what America is going to be as we push forward into the 21st century. And Dave, you are so right about what we're doing for rural renaissance across the country. I see that more and more. I know Tom Doerr wishes he could be here to talk a little bit more about that and what the Department of Agriculture is doing, but we're so proud more than anything to see how it's creating jobs and revitalizing hometowns across this country. Let me just close by saying, as I've said before, that this opportunity is with us right now, and the economics and the technology are on our side, but time isn't. And so we need the sense of urgency and the heightened sense of awareness that the Indy Race League and the Epic folks have helped us focus on this coming weekend. And we need to act like our nation's future depends on it. Because, ladies and gentlemen, our nation's future, my baby Julia's future, does depend on it. Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to a great race.
Our next guest is the director of the SmartWay program with the Environmental Protection Agency. Please make welcome Mr. Mitch Greenberg. Mitch.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Congratulations on the birth of your baby. I think it's a real testament to DOE's dedication that you would come here so soon after the birth of your daughter. I think that's worth mentioning. It's a real honor for EPA to join you here today at this famous Indianapolis Motor Speedway. This is the home where countless drivers have made racing history. We're thrilled that the IndyCar Series, Epic, and your teams are making history again this year by switching to 100% ethanol for all your races. By doing this, you not only become the first motorsports racing series to use a renewable biofuel, but you become the first organization almost anywhere to make this type of complete transition to a biofuel. It's very impressive, and it happened very quickly. You're highlighting clearly for all of us the importance of homegrown renewable fuels, the importance to our environment, to our energy security, and to our economy. We applaud your decision to use this fuel. It's an important step toward meeting the president's goal that you heard Andy Karsner talk about, to perhaps produce as much as 35 billion gallons by 2017. It's an incredibly aggressive goal. To reach those goals, we're going to have to create very strong demand for renewable fuels. And that's going to happen through racing series like this. You can reach so many people, and it's why we're so thrilled at EPA to work with you all. EPA's SmartWay program is also trying to create a demand for renewable fuels and cleaner, more efficient transportation. SmartWay is a public-private partnership between EPA and various industries. We launched the program in 2004 with our freight program. We since have launched a program that identifies SmartWay cars. We've also just a little while ago launched a program that identifies SmartWay trucks. And so when you see these cars, if you're shopping for a car and you see a SmartWay car, you know it's more sustainable, more fuel efficient, and has lower emissions than other cars. Same for trucks. If you're in the trucking business or you're hauling around the Indy cars, you also could be driving SmartWay trucks, tractor-trailer combinations. I mentioned we have over 550 companies in our program so far, and to date, those companies are saving 3 million tons of CO2 each year. That's not a big number yet, but that's great growth since we started our program, and we're really seeing corporate America come in and support these types of programs. We're growing very quickly. Our most recent component is the Grow and Go program, SmartWay's Grow and Go program. This program is specifically designed to promote the environmental benefits and the use of renewable fuels. Simple goal, straightforward. The key components to the program: increase the number of E85 stations and biodiesel stations in the U.S., increase sales and model options for flexible fuel vehicles, and get those vehicles to those pumps. Get people who are using flexible fuel vehicles, get them to fill those vehicles up with flexible fuel, with renewable fuel. And we're also working with our partners to develop additional feedstocks to create ethanol that has even greater environmental benefit. We've been working with really a very strong and amazing set of both public and private partners to achieve these goals, including the Department of Energy, General Motors, and many others. Today, I'm pleased to cordially invite EPIC, the IndyCar Series, your teams and your partners to join our SmartWay program and help EPA showcase the many benefits of renewable fuels to vehicle consumers, to corporations, and to racing fans. Using 100% ethanol in the IndyCar Series is a clear demonstration that the ethanol that fuels the finest performance cars in the world can be a legitimate fuel for our cars, for everyone. These fuels improve air quality, they reduce climate change emissions, and they reduce our dependency on foreign oil. Where's the downside? So good luck to all the drivers and teams on Sunday, but no matter who wins this year's Indy 500, by using ethanol, the IndyCar Series is helping all of us win. Thank you.
I'd also like to recognize another important person in the room today. He is the general manager of Innova Energy, the official fuel supplier for the IndyCar Series, Mr. Don Schwarzkopf. Don, where are you? If you would, stand up, please. There he is back here. Don, give Don a hand, if you will, please. Don, thank you very much. Our next guest is a person who's going to talk to us about global climate change and environmental benefits of ethanol from Global Warming 101 Expedition, Mr. Will Steigers. Will?
Hello. I want to thank Don and Ron and Diane Fagan and Ethanol for inviting me to speak to you today. I've lived a pretty interesting life. I've come from a family of nine kids. My father was a visionary in water flow and parts and filters in the 50s and 60s, and he supported the family that way. I inherited that ability to see no barriers. But more than that, our parents gave the nine of us total freedom. The first book that I read as a kid in third grade was The Adventures of Huck Finn, and that pretty much solidified my life. I knew where I was going. I wanted to live a life of adventure. When I was 12 years old, I used to caddy and cut lawns, and I bought my first old outboard motor, a wooden thing, and an old motor, Champion 16 and a half horse. Over the next year, I fixed that up and traded it in, kept working, and by the time I was 15 years old, after the third trade-in, I had a pretty decent boat, a 16-foot motor, and left Minneapolis with my older brother, who was 17, and we took that motorboat down Mississippi to New Orleans and back up from Minneapolis in about 3,000-mile trip. And that was actually my first and last motorized adventure. I started climbing and kayaking after that. I pretty much have had three careers throughout my life, all kind of simultaneously. Exploration, Arctic and polar has been, I've been traveling in the north for the last 42 years. And I'll show you a few pictures here coming up of some of the adventures I've been on. Unfortunately, the last 15 years, I've been the eyewitness to climate change and global warming in the polar region, something that the scientists had predicted 15 years ago. And I've traveled in areas where no people have ever been, and because of the remoteness, there's been no one that's really seen these changes firsthand that I have. I've also been an educator. I have a master's degree in education. I taught secondary science in the late 60s, ran my own winter program, outward bound program with dogs and skis up in northern Minnesota in the 70s. That got me into dog sledding. And the last 20 years, I've worked in internet online education. We actually started in the late 80s before the internet was on board, using telecommunications, primitive satellite connections at that time to get our expeditions and that into the classroom. And today now it's relatively easy. We can shoot up video, live pictures, we can get into classrooms in homes, millions of people, nation, internationally. And so we've used our expeditions as an educational platform. I'm also an environmentalist, not the type that hangs upside down on a bridge at rush hour traffic, but I'm a consensus builder. I've worked locally, state level, nationally in D.C. for the last 20 years. I've worked international. One of my fortes is bringing opposing views together around the common goals. I worked on issues with Al Gore in the late 80s, the ozone issues and preservation of Antarctica. And then, among other things, I've worked on global warming for the last 20 years. And it's been a hard fight until about a year ago when finally global warming came into the mainstream and we began to see that we have a major problem on our hands. I wanted to show you first pictures. Because of technical problems here, I have to signal in the back here, so it might be a little jerky. Just to give an idea, some of the expeditions I've been on. This is Antarctica, 89-90. The last 20 years I've traveled by, or 30 years actually, by dog team. We crossed the longest route, about 3,700 miles across Antarctica at that time. An international team of six people from six different countries. And we were up in the mountains, crevasses, and high plateaus as part of the adventure along the way. It took us 221 days to cross the continent. Our average temperature was 30 below with a 30-mile-an-hour wind, and we didn't see anything above zero on that trip, a lot of 40s and 50 belows. And then I crossed I've been on the North Pole a number of times, crossed the Arctic Ocean. Antarctica in the south is a high continent, our highest continent. It averages at 10,000 feet, whereas on the top of the globe here, the North Polar area is the Arctic Ocean. It's actually an ocean. At the pole, this is right close to the North Pole here, it's actually 15,000 feet deep of water. You're on ice that's now starting to break up earlier and earlier each year because of global warming. But this ice actually moves anywhere from 3 to 8 miles a day. So when you're standing on it, with the GPS, you can actually see yourself moving. But I've spent over half my career before the GPS was on. But the top of the globe is ice and water. And this is an expedition in 95 where we crossed from Russia to the pole down to Canada. And also been on the Greenland ice cap. Greenland contains about 12% of our fresh water in the world. We're hearing a little bit more about the edges of Greenland starting to slide into the ocean. The ice cap itself is stable. It's still not a real threat, but it's showing sides on the side of sides on the side. This is Antarctica. I'm not going to bore you with any graphs here, but I wanted to show you. This is a route across. Right here is the Antarctic Peninsula. In the next slide, I'll show a little close-up of that. That's the peninsula with Minnesota here to show you the size. This was the Larsen Ice Shelf in here. There's a mountain range in here, Larsen A, Larsen B. This was taken in 1990 when our route. This was 300 miles across here. It took us 31 days to cross. And then a couple of satellite photos here, right there. This is 2002. This is the mountain range here. Larsen A here disintegrated in 1998. This is the Larsen B ice shelf. Now, this took us 21 days to cross here. And the next shot is a little closer up, 21 days here. This is what it once looked like. And then in 2002, this entire thing within a four-week period, the entire thing disintegrated. And these blocks of ice here, you see right in the bottom here, the size of small New England states. This is definitely a global warming issue. I mean, if you've traveled across this thing day after day after day to get a sense of how large this was, but what's happening here, you have the ice shelves in the peninsula here disintegrating. The A and B have gone already, and that they kind of dam up the big glaciers, some of the largest glaciers in the world. They like a cork in a plug. You pull that plug out when the ice shelf disintegrates, the glaciers then start flowing into the water, and that's where eventually we'll see a sea level rise. And okay, yeah, this is just the top of the globe, showing the Arctic Ocean. This is the sea ice in the summertime, 1979 and 2003. You can see we lost about a fourth of that. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the loss of the summer sea ice, what our expedition that we were just on. But this will show you what's happening in the Arctic regions. And then one last slide here. I use Minnesota here as a size comparison. But the green and the colored areas here is permafrost. Permafrost is permanently frozen ground. Most of it's real deep swamp, 6 million square miles of it. And as long as it's frozen, it doesn't interact with the atmosphere. But if permafrost thaws out, which it's starting to do now in the summertime on the edges, when you thaw the swamp, it starts decaying. You have the decomposition of the organic materials, and that releases methane into the atmosphere. So the permafrost is one of the largest methane sinks. In other words, it's frozen. It's not interacting. This is the present permafrost. And this next shot will show you, if we go business as usual, the way we're consuming energy, putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, we'll lose 50% of that in the previous slide. This is 100 years from now. If we continue, we're going to lose 90% of that. But it's not just losing the permafrost. If that thaws out, you're looking at it thaws, it goes into the atmosphere. I testified in Congress in 1990 about the dangers of the permafrost melting, releasing methane. Now you're starting to read this in your mainstream media. So I just want to show you some of the crucial things here. And we organized an expedition that I just got back from on Thursday. We were sponsored by Fagan Engineering and Ethanol. And we traveled with 8 of us on the main team. We had 3 Inuit hunters, 5 of us from Minnesota. And we traveled up to Baffin Island. We're right down in here. Baffin is Eastern Canadian Arctic, Greenland. You might fly over this area when you're going to Europe. And this is a larger picture here. We traveled about 1,400 miles by dogs, and we visited these communities along the way. These communities are inaccessible except for planes. We had to cross mountain ranges along the sea ice to get to them. Our main purpose was basically to ground truth global warming from a cultural perspective, from the Eskimo people's perspectives. We had the hunters that we traveled with. They were basically our eyes and ears of what we were seeing. And I, from past experience, can observe some things, but these guys lived in the area and with their thousands of years of traditional knowledge that's been passed, and I'm very observant. But also in the villages, we interviewed hundreds of elders and hunters and people about what they were seeing and experiencing on climate change and global warming. We traveled by dog team. We had a couple teams, the local Inuit teams. These are Eskimo dogs, it's called. Very tough dogs. They love 30, 40 below is their perfect temperature. They would be very unhappy in this climate here. And our team, we had 2 dogs, dog teams, 20 dogs in Minnesota that we brought up. Ours are a mix of wolf and Siberian, and also the main bloodstock of our dogs are these Eskimo dogs, very energetic dogs. And we traveled here. They're pulling a dog team in a fan hitch. And this is a couple of the Inuit guys that I traveled with, Eskimo guys. The guy with the olive drab is a guy by the name of Luki. He's 65 years old, doesn't speak English. He was born in an igloo. Simon, above him, is 54 years old. He was born in a sod hut. Both these men were nomadic in their earlier years. Luki was a nomadic life half of his life. Myself, I had 40 years of experience. I was there to learn from them. One of our biggest conflict, trying to get the two cultures and the two styles together, is they don't go by the clock. A clock is not even in their consciousness. And they're totally different type of thinkers than we are. They're not aware of what our lifestyle down here is. They have, other than what they see on TV. They're very observant. They see things at very face value. They live totally in the present. So we had 3 Inuit guys. Abby Fenton on the right is one of the educators that was on the team. We had famous climber join us along the way here, Ed Vistras, a high elevation climber from Everest, and John Stetson, a guy on the right there. I've traveled with John for about 21 years. So we had a pretty good team of people here. Elizabeth Andre here on the right is an educator, PhD student at the University of Minnesota. So we're pretty heavy with educators on our side and the Inuit hunters. And Richard Branson and his son Sam joined us on the last 400-mile leg. And we were just together about last week up there. And then we traveled by dog team. You know, you can see the terrain here. Four dog teams. We had about 50 dogs. And up mountainous and a lot of sea ice. This is a mountain pass that we crossed, Pengerton Pass. Real windy, real stormy. This was in March here. We had really, really tough weather at that time. And that's on the sea ice. We traveled along the sea ice quite a bit with our teams. And with the Eskimo dogs are run what's called a fan hitch. Each dog is attached to a long line that's connected near the sled. But when the dogs cross, it causes this large knot. So about every 2 hours, pretty standard during the day, every 2 hours we'd stop. The Inuit guys would undo their knots. So this would be our break. Takes about 5 minutes to undo this knot here, 5-10 depends. And then we take a break here. These Inuit guys, this is like 20 below. There's about a 30-mile-an-hour wind here. You notice that one guy doesn't have gloves on, laying around having a cup of tea. Very adaptable to the cold. Very, very good attitude right at home in these temperatures. And then we're off and running here. Dogs are very, very high-spirited. And then at supper time here, we ate what it's called a lot of country food. This is caribou. We use a saw called a snow saw that they cut blocks with. We just basically cut up frozen pieces of the caribou. We had char. We ate pretty much a lot of meat. The Inuit, their diet is about 90% meat. A little bit of seal we were eating. They had a little bit of walrus along with them, so that was pretty much the diet. We set up camp. We used tents most of the way, not igloos. This is Richard Branson here. I'm showing him the ropes literally here of how setting up the tents. We bunked together for about a week, okay? And then we did an online program. Every night we'd stop usually around 6 o'clock, but we were connected, again, by telecommunications, and Abby and Elizabeth worked in their tents usually till midnight every day, putting together the daily program, pictures, a little bit of clips of videos. So we'd send those up daily. We had a website, Global Warming 101, tremendous following on that. Epic had it on a link on their website. In addition to the actual travel, we were in the communities. We talked with the schools, the elders, and the school kids, and presented to what we were doing in addition to the interviews that we did. We put together about 200 hours of film, a lot of interviews, and we did always the local radio. Radio is pretty much the standard way that people communicate. This one station, I showed you the last picture there. We walked in to do the interview. The guy showed us how to run the radio and then walked out on us. So we had the whole radio to ourselves for 3 hours and gave the interview in the town. And then this is one of the presentations that we did to the final community. The Igloolik was the name of this little village that we ended in. Our three hunters were from this area. And we had Jewel, the recording artist, came up last week along with Richard. We had a big free concert for the village. It was really, really a lot of fun, very successful project. And always work with the kids here. We're hooking them up like dogs here and pulling the sled so they can get an idea what the harnesses look like. Okay. In terms of what we saw, I'll just conclude here. This is middle of Baffin Island called the Barnes Ice Cap. Barnes Ice Cap is a small remnant of the last ice age. Very old ice here. It's about 25,000 years old, the scientists think. But we're getting warmer season, of course. We're getting later freeze-ups and earlier breakups. In other words, the winter is very strong. The winter is not as cold as it used to be, but on either end of the winter, we're starting to see the weather change. And this is reflected. This is a river, and there was overflow in the river. This is actually, the sled went through the first layer of ice. It's actually safe. It's on the main part of the ice here. The sled and the dogs should not have been in this position. The dogs kind of ran out in a bad place, and the sled went in. Not a major problem, but just happened on that sled load. All my personal gear and sleeping bag was at the bottom. And so what we did on that issue is we we hooked up a second dog team to the first dog team, and then we pulled the sled out together. But what you're seeing is much earlier thaws here. You can't just say because you fell in a river that it's global warming. We have a problem sometimes on the media dramatizing global warming, of looking at, okay, this hurricane or this tornado is global warming. It doesn't really work that way. Global warming, we're talking about the overall average of the Earth warming up. In some areas, actually, it's getting cooler. But overall, you know, if you look at the big mix of what's happening, the weather is changing. And we're really seeing the changes in the Arctic regions because the top of the globe is covered by snow and ice, and that ice used to, in the summer, reflect off radiation and kept the top of the Earth cool. And that's the reason why in the last 5,000 years we had relatively stable climate. I mean, climate has variation within it, but it's enabled us as a species to evolve because of agriculture. That's now changing. Because of the added carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that's been accumulating for a long time, we're not now finally seeing the effects. But that accumulated heat from human-induced greenhouse gases is being accumulated in the ocean. 80% of that energy is stored in the ocean. The ocean now is starting to warm. The sea level rise that we're seeing right now is thermal expansion. It's actually the water warming. The water is moving up. And that warming is going down, in some areas, down to 8,000 feet. Well, it plays out here in the next picture. Well, I'll show you in a bit. It plays out in the Arctic, where we're starting to lose the summer sea ice reflective area. Now, as we're losing the sea ice, it exposes land and water, so you're starting to see absorption. So there's a domino effect that's now happening in the Arctic. We're getting less ice, more absorption, and this is the reason why the climate is changing 3 to 4 times faster up there than down here. It's because of the loss of the sea ice. We also had an issue with the ozone hole, which is something, fortunately, we corrected the what's causing that, CFCs. But we had a tremendous, probably an opening in the ozone. In the northern hemisphere, right around May, end of April, the ozone opens. It's not like Antarctica, but it's sometimes it's quite intense. But this year, very intense ozone problem. Really fried my face, but we're rubbing cream here in the dog's nose. That was getting, first time ever that we had to put sunblock on a dog. But that ozone is a success story because that is starting to heal up itself. Next shot here. And this is what we're seeing now in the Arctic. It's just more and more open water. And this is an aerial view. I'll explain this. This is called the Cumberland Sound. It's about 50 miles across. These are mountains here. There's a community right here. A route normally would have taken us 50 miles this way. But this year, this entire sound opened up because of large waves at the end of January. They've never seen that happen before. This is probably a symptom of global warming. We went around the edges here to get around. And as soon as we got into the village, another storm came in and wiped out this whole area here. So this is, of anything we saw on the expedition, everybody's always looking for the smoking gun in global warming, and it's really hard to say, okay, this is global warming. Well, this is probably global warming related. It's this type of an event that has never happened before. This is an airplane looking down at this ice that totally broke up. And last couple pictures here, the bear population. We did see quite a few bears in Baffin Island. We were in one area where the females were coming out of denning with the cubs, and then in one area by the mountains, and the males were coming in on the other end to mate. So we were sort of in this shooting galleries of bears all over the place. But the bear population in this area was okay in the spring. But what we're starting to see, though, as we're losing more and more ice, any species like the bear or the walrus or certain seals that rely on this ice, the bears, for example, rely 95% of their diet is from seals, and the only way they can get a seal is on the ice. They can't swim after it. So if we lose that habitat, not only are we going to lose the bears, but the temperature is going to start changing. My last shot here. This is basically what we're seeing in the Arctic. A lot more thawing, and it's going to affect the culture. It's going to affect the animals that rely on it. But on a planetary scale, it's going to affect us in a very, very big way. Because as the ice starts disappearing now in the summer, and the scientists are predicting we're going to lose the summer sea ice by 2030. And I believe that's pretty much right on target from what I've seen, maybe a little earlier. But if we lose the summer sea ice, the whole heat balance of the globe will change. And that's the last shot here. I'll put it there. All right. Okay. I wrote a book 20 years ago called Saving the Earth. In that book, I had a chapter on global warming, and in that chapter, I talked about ethanol as being part of the solution. And I'm really happy to be here today and to be part of the ethanol revolution that's going on. I really believe in this industry. As an environmentalist, I've seen what's happening firsthand, and I'm not trying to scare you, but global warming is a very serious thing, and it's not something we're going to sweep under the carpet. It's a cumulative. It's something that's going to affect our children unless we act really quickly, and it's not very good news. But on the other hand, you know, we're looking at this problem, and humans, our tendency of putting your head in the sand when you have a problem. But on the other end of it, we have great hope. We have the technology in hand. I mean, we put a person to the moon. Developing the new technologies and the new fuels are actually easier than that. It's a market-driven. And I see that what's really needed as an environmentalist is a vision for our country of where we're going to go. And I see ethanol as part of the vision. And I look at ethanol not only where we're at now. Where we're at now is fine, because the market's driving it, there's investment, everyone's trying to make it better. We may not be perfect where we're at it right now, but we're going to make it better as time goes by. And I see a cellulosic ethanol as a vision 15, 20 years from now, gets online. And along with that, we need cars that get 80 miles per gallon in 10 or 15 years. I mean, 21 miles per gallon, we can make as much ethanol as we possibly could make. It's not going to matter unless we get the mileage up. And maybe even what you're demonstrating here, engines that are tailored-made for ethanol, for alcohol, maybe rather than redoing a gasoline engine. But the vision here of where the potential of ethanol, where we're going to go with this country, I do see America as a leader, is going to be a leader in the global warming issues, not only on the policy end of it, but in terms of developing the technologies and selling this technology to India and China. I mean, I just think, I really like situations where everything's on the line, where on one end here we're looking at a catastrophe, on the other end there's great hope. And what we need to do, I think, as a public is to rally that spirit, to show the direction where we need to go. And I'm really proud to be part of, to be here, to be part of this revolution. And I'm really indebted to Diane and Ron Fagan and Ethanol for supporting our expedition and believing in us and helping us get this important message out to the American public. Thank you.
Well, we want to thank you very much for everything you've done. A lot of you folks don't realize how hard Will has worked to take the far left and the far right and bring them together as a work as a team to promote the ethanol industry. And I think you know what we're talking about. And he's great at it. He's a great American hero. And thank you for everything you've done. Thanks.
I'd also like to recognize, if I could, the president of EPIC, Mr. Tom Braun. Tom, are you here? If you'd stand up, please. Tom, where are you? There you are, Tom. Congratulations. Thank you, sir. My apologies to Dan Schwarzkopf, not Don. Dan, sorry. Thank you very much. Now let's continue our program, and let's bring up, if I can, a couple of honored speakers. First, the Chevrolet General Manager, Mr. Ed Pieper, and the Lieutenant Governor of the great state of Indiana, Becky Skillman.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, and good morning. It is an honor to be back this year at the Ethanol Summit and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, home of the greatest spectacle in racing. And this historic track has always held a special place in Chevrolet's heritage, a legacy that dates all the way back to our founder, Louis Chevrolet, who raced so many times here. Chevrolet will again play a big role this Sunday as our Corvette leads the field to the green flag under the command of actor and racer and Grey's Anatomy star Patrick Dempsey. This will be the record 18th time Chevy has paced the race in its 91-year history and the ninth time for Corvette, the most of any nameplate here at the track. In addition to the Speedway, Chevy and GM have also had a long and valued relationship with the state of Indiana. Indiana is home to 5 plants, 200 dealers, 10,500 GM employees, and 42,000 GM retirees. And the success of this state, its economy, and its people matter greatly to us. And it's one reason why we are so proud to take the lead on encouraging alternative fuel usage here, like the ethanol that will power the racers on Sunday and will power vehicles that drive Indiana's roads for many, many years to come. In fact, Chevrolet, as GM's volume leader, must also lead in providing a complete fuel solutions portfolio to help end our dependence on foreign oil. Just a couple of examples. At the North American International Auto Show in Detroit in January, we unveiled a major contributor to our fuel solution strategy at GM, the 4-passenger Chevy Volt concept vehicle. Volt can travel 40 miles without using one drop of gasoline, which may be the ultimate solution to virtually eliminating fuel stops altogether. It is an absolutely amazing vehicle. We invite you to take a look at it in the display next to the Racing Museum. And last week, we took another big step forward when our Chevy Sequel, the world's most technologically advanced car, became the first electrically driven fuel cell with a range extender that can run on ethanol and get 150 miles per gallon. This test was a precursor to our fleet of more than 100 Chevrolet Equinox fuel cell vehicles that will run an extended real-world test in major markets this fall. These are all great examples of where this industry is headed, but today we're here to focus our leadership on one specific fuel solution, and that's E85 ethanol. And here, our company has stepped to the forefront of the development process. Today, 14 GM vehicles are E85 compatible, and 8 of them are Chevrolets, including all of our full-size pickups and our utilities. In fact, nobody offers more flexible fuel vehicles than General Motors. We already have more than 2 million E85-capable vehicles on the road, and Chevy offers more E85-compatible cars and trucks than any other major manufacturer. So as you can imagine, we were very, very pleased that the visionaries in the Indy Racing League have delivered on their commitment to run on 100% ethanol. The higher octane, the better performance, and the renewable characteristics of E85 make it the logical choice for the IRL, and the same is true for today's passenger cars and trucks. For example, did you know that driving a new flex fuel Tahoe on 100% E85 ethanol for 15,000 miles would use 120 fewer gallons of gasoline than driving a compact hybrid over the same distance? Hybrids are an important pathway as we will market the Tahoe hybrid, the two-mode system, this fall. But the E85 pathway is equally and in many ways more important. As all of you know, E85 helps reduce smog and greenhouse gas emissions, which is really great for the environment. And Andy mentioned his baby daughter being born. I also had our first daughter born 4 weeks ago, Emma. And if it doesn't open your eyes even more as to how important this is for our youth and for our children going forward, then it really should. It really supports our agricultural industry. It helps our nation create greater diversity in its energy supply and its sources. We are eager, very eager, to continue to see this technology grow. It is one reason we are working with so many states and fuel providers around the country to supply more E85 refilling stations. Indiana is an unbelievable example of that collaboration. We've been very, very impressed with the dramatic progress that this state has made in renewable fuels development. For example, in 2006, GM and the state of Indiana teamed up to grow flex fuel availability with 21 new E85 pumps at Meijer stores. And at that time, I Lieutenant Governor Becky Skillman a new flex fuel Tahoe. It was part of our partnership with the Governor's Ethanol Coalition to loan E85 vehicles to 30 states and organizations. And today I have more great news. And on behalf of Chevy and more than 4,000 Chevrolet dealers nationwide, I am delighted to continue our partnership by extending the Tahoe's stay in Indiana and several other states for another year. So here are the keys. Becky, and congratulations and thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. I know that. Thank you. Please.
Well, Ed, it's great to be with you once again, and of course, I accept on behalf of a very grateful state. And let me just say how this gives me a great opportunity to thank you for your great partnership with the Governor's Ethanol Coalition, the continuation of that partnership. But I want to thank you as well for putting more flex fuel vehicles on the road. I think each of us here today know if biofuels are to be truly successful, we need to focus on availability. We need to focus on the ability to use biofuels, and our state has had a great deal of success, almost gone from nowhere to national leadership in a short period of time on both fronts, and General Motors has been our great partner every step along the way. You know, they were standing beside us when we celebrate with communities or companies that install E85 pumps. GM has been a great partner as well on our Biotown USA project, Reynolds, Indiana, a community of 500 or so that's working to become entirely self-sufficient in their energy needs. GM rolls into town with 20 flex fuel vehicles, and 20 residents of that community have, you know, an opportunity to drive those vehicles for a year. Actually, more than 100 or 150 families now in that community driving flex fuel vehicles, the highest per capita users of flex fuel technology probably in the world. So we appreciate your great partnership in so many ways. And, of course, this is the third year in the month of May at the track. General Motors has been so kind to loan to me a Chevy Tahoe, runs on E85. We estimate in this last year alone, we've used around 1,700 gallons of E85, and as you know, that's grown each year. We have more communities now where you can purchase E85 rather than the state's motor pool. And this is a great educational tool for the state. You know, we travel a lot, and nearly every day someone stops us to ask if their vehicle is equipped to use E85 or where they can purchase it. We're helping to raise the awareness and attempting to make biofuels, bioenergy, an important part of our state's culture. We're very conspicuous on the highways, however, Ed. The last Tahoe, in addition to the corn wraparound, also has the state flag emblazoned on the back with my name on the side. And Bart, where's Bart? Bart is here today, my new assistant and driver. So I told him just a couple of days ago, you know, Bart, we are so conspicuous on the highways, we can't get stopped for traffic violations because the world will know it's us. And in addition to all the great things you do, that Tahoe, you know, is a great ride. Some of my friends here have heard me say before, it's quite an upgrade from that state government-issued navy blue sedan with no hubcaps. We are a frugal administration. And we thank you once again, Ed, not only for your partnership in ethanol, biofuels, and green power, if you will, but we want to thank you for all the jobs you provide to Hoosiers, General Motors still being the number one provider of manufacturing jobs in our state. So thanks again on so many fronts, and can't wait to wheel around.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. This partnership is just one example of our national Live Green, Go Yellow campaign. It is aimed at boosting the use and the knowledge of E85 ethanol. And I'd like to acknowledge a special person who's here today. He has single-handedly championed the E85 efforts at GM. He is the father of Live Green, Go Yellow. He is the driving force behind the fuel solution strategies at General Motors, and he's our North American Vice President for Sales, Service, and Parts, and he's a terrific guy, Brent Dewar. Brent? In conclusion, Chevy and GM will remain committed to E85 technology. We will help all the states and different organizations spread the word. We plan to announce a lot more partnerships in the year ahead. Bottom line, for alternative fuels to succeed, awareness is really the key. And again, we really applaud the IRL for the groundbreaking step they have taken with ethanol fuels. We congratulate, again, the state of Indiana for their commitment to E85 and really serving the energy needs of our customers today and going forward. Again, thanks for having GM and Chevy participate. Have a great day.
Our next speaker, I am proud to bring up here. In 2004, he was a member of the Indy Pro Series, the cars that will be running here today, practicing and qualifying and then competing in the Freedom 100 here at the Annapolis Motor Speedway tomorrow. He so impressed car owner Mo Nunn that he took an extra car out of his stable and put this young man in the 2004 Indianapolis 500. And when the unenviable task of taking Paul Dana's place came up, there were a lot of people who wanted that ride, and this gentleman was selected not only because of his driving skills, but his involvement in wanting to take ethanol to the next level. Please welcome the driver of the number 17 ethanol, Delara, and man, you'll see you running the Indianapolis 500 on Sunday, Mr. Jeff Simmons.
Whew, I made it. I was told, actually, when I got here, I was going to be speaking after Mr. Steger, but I guess we had our own version of bump day here today. I finally made it at the last second, I guess. Actually, when I met Will, it was right before he went off on his expedition, so it's good to see him back. And we were up in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I was dressed basically like I am today, except for with a light jacket on. And I think it was like negative 13 degrees or something that day. And I said, you know what, buddy? I think we picked the wrong day to talk about global warming here, but I earned my snowshoes that day, I guess, and it was he didn't show any of the pictures in his slides there, but I was actually huddled in between all the dogs. You couldn't really see me. My head was sticking out a little bit. You might have seen my hair. I'm not sure. But thank you for having me here today and for all of you coming. As a driver for Team Ethanol, you know, this is not just a partnership for me, but it's a cause that impacts a lot of people. And it's a movement that is changing the way that society thinks about fuel and energy. I've seen corn turn to ethanol firsthand, from driving a combine in the field to visiting ethanol plants to using it in my own car. And each day, I'm more and more impressed with its high performance attributes and its economic and environmental benefits. I've traveled the country talking to people. We do a lot of pump tours. We get to meet face-to-face and educate people. And what they ask me is, how has this transition affected the performance of your car on the speedway? I say, well, the short answer really is that the 100% fuel-grade ethanol doesn't change the performance much at all. We have a little better torque, a little bit broader power band, and a little bit better mileage. You know, down in the pits, we get the added benefit that it's a cleaner burning fuel. So our crews are down there breathing easier. And it's a win-win for all of us in IndyCars. Even with the obvious environmental and economic benefits, we still had to convince our engineers, though, that the transition to 100% fuel-grade ethanol made sense from a performance standpoint. And with its octane of 113, it provides that high performance that our vehicles demand. We demonstrate under some of the harshest automotive conditions possible that the performance of our cars and the environmental responsibility can coexist at the same time. Now, if our Indy cars can run around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway at 220 miles per hour safely and effectively, that presents a powerful statement to consumers when given that choice at the pump. Ethanol-enriched fuel is the highest-performing fuel available on the market today. It burns cleaner, it leaves fewer gummy deposits in cars, and so it keeps the engine cleaner and allows it to achieve its optimal performance. It also helps to reduce pre-ignition problems like pinging and knocking. So what I'm really happy and proud to say here today is that I'm honored to share the track with a cleaner-burning renewable fuel cultivated in our fields of America that provides promise for America's energy future. Thank you very much for having me here today, and I hope all of you enjoy the race on Sunday, when I think it will be an eye-opening experience for everybody to see just how current, how ready ethanol is to power our vehicles in the future. Thank you.
If you have a question, we will ask you to stand, if you will, and direct the question. Tell us who you're directing the question to. And I don't know if this thing is going to work or not. What's that? Turn it on. Oh, there you go. We have an engineer up here to help me. Check one, two, check. Hey, how about that? There we go. If you have a question for somebody, just raise your hand. We'll come out. Let me know who you're directing it to. Plus, those green flags, the ethanol flags, that is the replica of the green flag that will start the Indianapolis 500, as well as all the IndyCar Series races this year. Take those flags home with you. Please don't make the mistake of thinking, why are they waving the Brazil flag to start the Indy 500? That is not the situation. That is the ethanol flag. So if you would, take those with you. Tell us who your questions for, sir.
Okay. For Mr. Pieper and anyone else from the auto industry, President Bush's executive order on greenhouse gases last week, half of that, of course, was the $35 billion ethanol target. The other part was fuel efficiency standards, et cetera. Basically, the one kind of the consumer concern has been ethanol mileage versus conventional gasoline. Basically, what's GM and anyone else representing the automakers here, what's being done maybe to improve that fuel efficiency specifically for ethanol fuels?
Sir?
Yeah, we're working on a lot of different technologies right now to improve the miles per gallon. Obviously, right now, for folks, when gas prices are soaring, the E85 is really a good buy, and people can see the economic, benefits of it right now. But we're working on a lot of technology going forward, and a lot of additional vehicles we want to put E85 into. You know, at Chevy right now, we pretty much have our core volume vehicles represented. When you look at our full size trucks and our utilities, it's such a big part of our business. You know, Impala has it, really, really big volume vehicle for us on the car side. So we're also, it's not only about improving the technology, the efficiency, though, it does run hotter, and it does. And the efficiency of the engine is actually much, much better. But as we look to do future product platforms for us, we're trying to add it to even more vehicles. But I can just tell you, we are working very, very hard to try to improve the miles per gallon.
Next question, anybody? Questions? Nobody? All right. Well, if that no more questions, then we want to thank everybody for coming out here this afternoon. Enjoy the practice for the Indy Pro Series. Take your flags home and enjoy the 91st running of the greatest spectacle in racing, the Indianapolis 500, on Sunday. Thank you.